Arthur 9, Chapter 1. There is a window, a brief gray window in the pre-dawn, when the cul-de-sac belongs to the watchers, and the light remains too thin to catch a man moving in the periphery. Arthur takes it. He moves with a calculated economy of motion, recognizing the specific gray of the pre-dawn as a flat, low-resolution filter. He grips the aluminum ladder. The cold metal bites into the pads of his palms with a dry, biting resonance. He mounts the fourth rung. He identifies the specific angle of the lens on the Nest camera. His movements stay steady as he reaches for the side of number 12. He slots the screwdriver into the mounting head. He applies 4 pounds of downward pressure. He turns the driver until the plastic bracket groans, a sharp, grinding friction that vibrates through the tool and into his wrist. 3 rotations, counterclockwise. The lens tilts 5 degrees toward the sidewalk. The glass settles. It focuses on the canopy of the oak tree. He builds a sanctuary of invisibility where his own front door once stood, ensuring the surveillance feed captures a world that has already deleted him and what he protects. He descends with the quiet efficiency of a man who knows that being seen results in being dismantled. He folds the aluminum frame. The hinges strike the stopper with a final metallic resonance. He crosses the property line with a heavy, deliberate stride and enters his own kitchen. The linoleum is cold through the soles of his shoes. The floorboards carry the vibration of the house before the sound arrives. Scrape. Drag. Click. The 3-beat pressure of the 1972 Det anchors his spine. The steel of Claire's brace strikes the wood at a frequency of 1 beat per second. The sound serves as a structural burden, reminding him of the exact second he miscalculated the intersection and applied the force that broke her. He enters the garage. He prefers the control of the physical fix. He places the screwdriver in the wall rack, 3rd slot from the left. He aligns the handle with the vertical axis of the bench. He locks the door. The latch strikes the plate. The structure holds. The room remains cold. It is a converted bedroom at the front of the house, a space stripped of everything except the mahogany desk and the view of the cul-de-sac. Arthur sits. He anchors himself to the chair. This is the grid. It stands as the only structure between the hallway and the raw, uncalculated friction of the street. He watches through the slats of the blinds, cataloging the nuances of 16 houses. Observation always precedes analysis. He monitors the gates. He records the exact pressure Mrs. Parker applies to her brakes, the way her SUV dips under her hesitation, the specific 4-second pause she takes at the stop sign when she believes she remains unobserved. Every movement carries a cost. Every delay represents a potential crack in the equilibrium. He tracks the arrival of the mail at 14:10 and the departure of the garbage truck at 07:15, treating these mundane events as the gears of a clock that only he knows how to wind. Arthur Penhaligon stands before the mirror in the hallway. He wears a short-sleeved button-down shirt, the fabric pressed into crisp white angles that reflect the discipline of his closet. He is 65 years old, with skin the color of old ledger paper and eyes that possess the flat, unblinking focus of a surveyor's level. He maintains a posture of rigid verticality. He holds his spine as a structural defense against the gravitational pull of his own history. His hair is a thin, silver receding line, cut with a precision that leaves no room for variation. He looks like a man who has spent his life searching for a decimal point in a sea of fraud. Leo Parker pedals his tricycle on the sidewalk. The plastic wheels grind against the asphalt, a high-frequency broadcast of vulnerability that vibrates through the window glass. The boy seeks the attention Arthur spent a lifetime shedding. He wants the world to notice him. He seeks the gaze of every passerby. Visibility invites the strike. Arthur learned the cost of being seen in The Intersection, 1972, when he acted as a savior and produced a tragedy. Arthur sees the 1968 blue sedan. The chrome grille captures the orange glare of the street lamp, stretching the light into a jagged spear. The metal is a mirror, reflecting the individual pits in the road and the shimmering, iridescent purple iris of an oil slick near the storm drain. He feels the 30 pounds of pressure trapped in his palms. He applied the force to Claire's left shoulder, intending a rescue. The math failed. He hears the low-frequency thud of the push, a hammer striking a bag of flour, followed by the moan of locking tires. The rubber grinds against the wet concrete, a high-pitched metallic wail that vibrates through the soles of his shoes. The final sound is the femur. It is a hollow, dry snap, like a frozen branch breaking in the woods. He misjudged the distance. He miscalculated the speed of a threat he thought he understood. He became the reason his sister's skeleton is half steel. The incident stays in his marrow. It becomes bone. It becomes the permanent structure he is built on, a skeletal architecture of guilt and surveillance. The house remains a preservation of his father's era. It sits at the head of the cul-de-sac, a two-story brick colonial that commands the street. Inside, lemon oil glints on the sideboards, and the metallic resonance of the steel brace Claire wears hums through the floorboards. Arthur keeps the furniture in the exact positions they occupied in 1972. He treats the rug in the hallway and the mahogany desk in the front room as fixed points in a shifting world. Any deviation in the placement of a chair feels like a breach in the security of the home. He walks toward the kitchen. He hears the rhythmic arrival of his sister before she appears. Scrape, drag. Claire enters the room. She wears a floral apron over a faded cotton dress that emphasizes the slight, permanent curvature of her spine toward the right hip. Gray hair, sparse and silvered at the roots, gathers in a tight, sensible knot at the nape of her neck. Her skin possesses the translucent quality of vellum, revealing a map of pale blue veins across the backs of her hands. Her eyes appear clouded by a milky film, the iris a faded, distant blue. She grips the edge of the counter, with fingers that have thickened at the joints, her knuckles showing white against the wood as she stabilizes her frame. "The Parkers are out in the yard again," she says. Arthur watches Sarah Parker through the slats. She stands 5'2". Her frame appears skeletal inside an oversized gray hoodie. Brittle, straw-colored hair falls from a messy ponytail and sticks to her face. Thin blue veins trace a map across her temples and the backs of her hands. Her hazel eyes dart across the asphalt. She hunches her shoulders and grips the frayed cuffs of her sleeves. Claire places the tray on the table. She moves with a practiced, labored grace. Arthur watches the way her right shoulder dips with every step, the mechanical lock of the brace dictating the geometry of her movement. He identifies the physical cost of every step she takes in his house. "The boy is pedaling on the sidewalk," Arthur replies. "He is broadcasting his position to the entire street. He is a child, Arthur. He is supposed to play. Play is a lack of focus. It is a suspension of the rules. The street does not suspend its rules for children." He takes his cup. He drinks it black. He prefers the bitter, honest heat of the water. He looks at Claire. She is the metric of his life. She is the reason he retired early from his firm to maintain the watch. She is the living balance sheet of his greatest failure. Every time the metal of her brace clicks against the floor, it adds a debit to his soul. His career as an accountant taught him the morality of the ledger. Numbers remain honest. Numbers provide a defense against the sudden, ugly spasm of survival that the uninitiated call an accident. "You are staring at the new neighbor's house," she says. Her voice remains low. "You have been at the window since 4 this morning." The variable changed, Claire. Daniel Blackwood occupied number 12. He represents a significant shift in the local frequency. Arthur occupies the solitude of the sentinel. He accepts the burden of the observer. He treats his isolation as a prerequisite for clarity. He remains the unseen auditor of the street's survival, a man refined by the precise metrics of his own penance. He occupies the center of a self-imposed audit. He chose this front room for the vantage point it provides, a vantage point that commands the street from the entrance to the terminal curve. He maintains the property with the same precision he once brought to a corporate balance sheet. He treats the neighbor's movements as entries in a ledger that must always balance. He anchors his existence in the discipline of the grid, aware that a single overlooked variable in 1972 broke a girl's leg. He remains 65 years old, yet he resides permanently in the seconds before the impact. He maintains a constant gaze. He carries the mass of the only man on the street with the eyes to see the crash before it happens. Arthur prepares the next entry in the ledger. He tracks the transit patterns of the Hendersons at number 10. He notes the 2-second delay in their mail retrieval. He records the flicker of the street lamp at 22:14, a rhythmic stutter in the dark that suggests a failing circuit. He treats the street as a single, massive organism. He remains the antibody. He remains the wall. Arthur prepares the entry for Daniel Blackwood. He creates a clean space in the ledger. He tracks the military rhythm of the man's walks and the frequency of his movements. He waits for the full set of metrics to align. He treats the arrival as a puzzle requiring a missing piece. He rotates the gold ring on his finger, feeling the heavy friction of the metal against his skin. He watches the gates. He waits for the variable that will finally force the correction.